Have you heard the story of the young boy named Johnny, who one Sunday after church said to his parents, "I have got to see the minister. I've got to see the minister right now." So Johnny was ushered into the minister's office and sat in the chair in front of the minister's desk, swinging his little legs, and he said, "Did I hear you say that Adam was created from the dust?" And the minister said, "Well, yes, Johnny, that's exactly right." And Johnny said, "And did I hear you say that when we die, we go back to the dust?" And the minister said, "Well, what a good listener you were, Johnny. That's exactly right. Is there a problem?" And Johnny said, "I think you better come home with me right now and look under my bed, because there's lots of people there coming and going." A lot of misconceptions about that story, actually. So last week, we completed our series on the first creation story in Genesis, the story that tells of our own creative process. And today, we're going to look at the second story of creation, the story of Adam and Eve. We can only imagine the confusion of a reader who has finished the first story, telling of the creation of the heavens and the earth, the two great lights, all the vegetation on the earth, and finally the creation of humankind. And then the seventh day story actually ends with God rested from all the work. We talked about that last week. God rested from all the work that he had done in creation. These are the generations of the heavens and the earth that were created. But then, right in the middle of that same verse 4 in Genesis 2, we read, "In the day that the Lord made the heavens and the earth, when no plant of the earth was yet on the earth, and no herb of the field had yet sprung up, for the Lord God had not caused it to rain upon the earth, and there was no one to till the ground." Well, how can that be? We just read that humankind was on the earth, and now we're reading there's no one to till the ground. Certainly seems to be a contradiction, does it not? And really one of many. We looked at this chart at the very beginning of our series, but I want to revisit it again really quickly. In the first story, heavens, vegetation, and all the animals are created before humankind. In the second, man is created first. In the first story, man and woman are created together at the same time in the image and likeness of the divine. In the second, man is created first and woman is created from man's rib. In the first story we talked about last week, God rests on the seventh day of creation. In the second story, there's no mention of resting, but there is mention of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And in both stories, it says that humankind is given dominion over the animals, which we said means dominion over our own thoughts and feelings. Now, before we look more closely at the story of Adam and Eve, let's just remember for a moment that they are two separate allegories, really recorded centuries apart by different groups of writers. Neither story was meant to be literal history. In fact, there was no such thing as literal history in the day. These tales are really a combination of story, myth, allegory, and poetry, full of beautiful symbolic imagery, some of which we don't get in our modern-day English. And like all the stories of the Bible, they hold deep personal meaning when we view them as metaphysical representation of our own journey, our own spiritual awakening. Now, we know from our first study of the creative process that the first story, recorded by the priestly writers, describes the spiritual ideal creation, wherein God is great creative mind at work. And as I've already said, gives us an idea about our own creative powers, our own creative process. It is in the second story, though, that we're going to look at today, written by the Yahwist writers, where these ideas really become manifest. So let's pick the story up in Genesis 2, verse 7, and we read, "Then the Lord formed man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being. And the Lord God planted a garden in Eden in the east, and there he put the man whom he had formed. Out of the ground the Lord God made to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food, the tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. All right. Okay. Now, metaphysically, we know that this story really tells us, Charles Fillmore tells us any rate, that the Garden of Eden is not a physical garden, but a state of consciousness, a state of beauty, harmony, and growth. And when we dwell in Eden, we dwell in bliss. That's what Eden really means. And did you notice the garden is in the east? It says Eden is in the east. In scriptural symbology, east always represents within us. And the tree of life that is right in the middle of the garden, in the midst of the garden, represents the eternal, omnipresent life of God within. And the tree of knowledge of good and evil, then, represents a dual state of consciousness, a belief in both good and error. And Adam, really Adam in the Hebrew, means man, humankind. So metaphysically, Adam represents all of humankind, and our story continues. Then the Lord God took the man and put him into the Garden of Eden to till and keep it. And the Lord God commanded the man, "You may eat freely of every tree in the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat. For the day that you eat of it, you shall die." Then the Lord God said, "It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him a helper as his partner." Okay. All righty. Sorry, I'm out of order here. All right. Sorry. Okay. Now, we know that, we see that, man is placed in the garden to dress it and keep it, right? To take care of it. And that means to care for and express the pure ideas of divine mind. And next, as we all know, God creates every animal of the field and birds of the air for the man, but none of these is a suitable partner. So next, God causes a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and he takes one of Adam's ribs to make woman, and God brings her to the man. Then Adam names the woman Eve, and they become one flesh. Now, historically, we realize that in this story, we know that in the day, I should say, women were regarded as chattel, property, household drudges, only servants to men's appetites. And that's the context in which this story was told. But interestingly enough, even after that, throughout history, subjugation of women has been justified because in this version, Eve is created from the man's rib and after the man. And by the way, she's the one tempted, right, by the serpent to eat the apple. Bible scholar Ed Townley notes that metaphysically, Eve is not a separate being, an afterthought, but the allness of Adam separated into two energies. Regardless of gender, each one of us is an expression of the divine through our own Christ, and we contain all the aspects of God, the feminine and the masculine. And so that means the power of God expresses through us as these two complementary entities, the feminine energy of love and the masculine energy of wisdom that we talked about during the creative process. So the saga continues. The serpent tempts Eve to eat the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And notice, did you notice that the text never ever says it is an apple? In fact, apples do not grow in the desert climates of the Mediterranean. I can attest to that, right? So how it became an apple, I'm not sure. But at any rate, Genesis 3, now we're into Genesis 3, all right. This is a really long story, which is why I'm skipping around a little bit. Genesis 3 in verse 6 says, "So when the woman saw the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And she also gave some to her husband, who was with her, and he ate. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together and made loincloths for themselves." Now, it's important to realize that up to this point, Adam and Eve are still in a spiritual state. They're not yet manifest in the physical. Notice they coexist peacefully and idyllically with the animals of the earth and one another. See the lion sleeping peacefully beside the lamb, no predator, no prey, everybody getting along and living in harmony. And Adam and Eve are living in a state of innocence. No discord, no fear, no embarrassment, no shame, no comparisons of good and evil. And that's an important point. Very important point. Nothing, just think about it for a minute, nothing in the garden has changed. But now, all of a sudden, the two see things differently. They feel unprotected, naked, and defenseless, even fearing their own creator. And so we read, as the story continues, they heard the sound of God walking in the garden at the time of the evening breeze, and the man and his wife hid themselves in the presence of the Lord among the trees of the garden. But the Lord God called to the man and said, "Where are you?" And the man said, "I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and so I hid myself." So notice when God asks if they've eaten from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, Adam blames Eve, right? Eve blames the serpent in what Ed Townley calls the first biblical example of passing the buck. And because of their disobedience, God condemns the serpent to crawl upon the earth, condemns the woman to suffer in childbirth, and condemns the male, the man, to endlessly toil in the earth. And the text says, "Lord God made garments of skin for the man and for his wife and clothed them." Not exactly a happy ending, but one really suitable for the purpose of the story's telling. Just imagine, in ancient times, people gathered around a campfire at night, wondering why, if they were created in the image and likeness of God, why did they have to suffer on this earth? Something that we still ask ourselves today. Why is life so hard sometimes? And Elizabeth Sand Turner notes, this story, this Adam and Eve story, answers that question. It provides an entertaining narrative with all these characters, you know, Adam and Eve and the serpent and God, all these characters that explain the challenges of human existence. And from this myth, this story, told over 3,000 years ago, traditional Christianity has taught that all of us are born in original sin because of Adam and Eve's sin of disobedience. Now, that concept of original sin did not come from the writings of the Old Testament prophets. It's nowhere in the Old Testament. It did not come from the mouth of Jesus. There is really little development of the teaching of the origin of original sin before the 4th century AD, when it was popularized by Augustine. This concept held that we are not only personally guilty and condemned for the sins of Adam and Eve, but we inherit the weakness and the inclination to be sinners ourselves, miserable sinners, as Greg Nettler says, scum-sucking sinners. That's what the doctrine of original sin says. Metaphysically, we see the story very differently. We see it not as the fall of humankind. Note that the word fall is never used in the text. But we see it as a physical embodiment of spiritual man into the physical world. The garment of skins for the man and his wife represent the moment when they take on physical bodies. And we did not fall from perfection, but were simply emerged. We emerged from the ideal, first as involution and then as evolution. We are still spiritual creatures, clothed for a time in a human body. And as Ed Townley notes, God intends us to move into a dualistic experience, to learn how to lovingly exercise our infinite creative power that we share with the allness of God. In other words, we are here on this earth to express all of our divine qualities, our godness, in this physical realm. And we can never be separate from our spiritual source except in our own consciousness. We're born in the image and likeness of the divine, as we learned in the first story, and we also have free will. We have the will and the right to choose everything on this human plane of existence. We can see it as good, or we can see it as what? Evil, bad. That's exactly right. And maybe that is the main lesson in this story for all of us as we explore our own spiritual unfoldment. Clothed in human skins, it does seem like we are judgment machines, aren't we, sometimes? And we like to label everything good or bad according to our own consciousness. Now, I know I've told this story before, but it's one of the best examples of our propensity to rush to judgment, our inclination to label every event as good or bad, right or wrong. And it's the story of the Chinese farmer, a lot of you know it, who one day, one of his horses, he only had one lone horse to till his very meager farm, and one day it ran into the hills surrounding the village. And so all the villagers gathered around, moaning and groaning and saying, "Oh, this is bad. This is very bad. This is a catastrophe. This is a disaster." But the farmer said, "Good, bad, who knows?" And then a couple of days later, the horse returned. But with the horse came a whole herd of wild horses from the hills. So now all the villagers gather around and they're saying, "Oh, this is good. This is very good. This is a blessing. You are a lucky man." And the farmer said, "Good luck, bad luck, who knows?" The next event, the one son of the farmer was riding one of the horses, and he fell off and broke his leg in three pieces. So once again, all the mourners gather around, and don't we all have those in our lives? Gather around and said, "Oh, this is bad. This is so bad. This is a disaster. This is a catastrophe." But once again, the man said, "Good, bad, who knows? We shall see. We shall see." And just two or three days later, a marauding army came through the village, and they took every single eligible male into their army, conscripted them into the army. But when they took one look at the farmer's son, lying there with his leg propped up and, you know, all bandaged up, and they thought, "He's no good," so they left him and went on. And just a few weeks later, the son's leg was completely healed. The horses were all there to work the land, and the farmer tilled all of the land and raised food for the entire village. So, good story about how we label everything good or bad. Now, Lowell Fillmore tells us, let me back up a little bit, back to the first creation story, kind of tying these two together. In the first creation story, God-mind creates the ideal world. And there's no dichotomy of bad or good. None at all. Only a benevolent God who has created humankind in his image, blessed all that he's created, and declared everything in absolute goodness. Yet the Adam and Eve story give us another perspective, don't they? Doesn't it? And Lowell Fillmore tells us that the significance of the story is that beginning with Adam and Eve, humankind has been following the hard way of living by experimenting to find the difference between good and evil instead of following God's instructions to the path of absolute goodness. We separate ourselves actually from God's perfect creation, the kingdom of heaven, by thinking that God's creation is both good and evil. It's this double vision, this double-mindedness, if you will, that causes us to worry, fear, be unhappy, or dwell in negative thoughts and emotions. In other words, when we fail to see the good in a situation, we fail to see God in it. And God is in every situation that we experience. As spiritual beings, we need to understand that we can always choose to look for the good, even in the most challenging situations. We can ask, "How can I serve from this? How can I love from this? What good can I bring to this? And as Chris Prentice writes, it's really only our perception of difficulties that causes us distress. When we label events as bad, we fail to perceive the benefit that is waiting for all of us. And I know you probably heard this story also of the old Cherokee who told his grandson, "My son, there is always a battle between two wolves inside of us. One is evil. It's anger, jealousy, greed, resentment, inferiority, lies, and ego. But the other one is good. It's joy, peace, love, hope, humility, kindness, and truth." And the little boy thought about that for a long time, and then he said to his grandfather, "But grandfather, which one wins?" And the grandfather, the wise old man, quietly replies, "My son, the one wins whom you feed." And so, really, maybe we are in the midst of our human experience, wearing these human skins to continually, day by day, thought by thought, act by act, learn which wolf we want to feed. To learn to align our thoughts, our actions, with a true identity of ourselves as spiritual beings as we return to our true spiritual center. Eric Butterworth notes that we are created with an ascending urge, an upward urge that is indestructible and will always rise again. Some people call this the God gene. We call it the indwelling Christ. And Butterworth says that not just the ancient myth of Adam and Eve, but the entire Bible is the story of our forgetting our spiritual nature, sinking into materiality, and then seeming to be in bondage, like the Hebrew people enslaved by the Egyptians. We find our freedom. We reconnect with our wholeness. And through it all, through every single moment of our lives in this plane of existence, we are absolutely assured of the unconditional love of God and all the powers of the Christ in that inner kingdom that Jesus talked about so much and our daily word addressed today. That inner kingdom where we know all the love and peace and harmony of the divine, where we are all the love and peace and harmony of the divine. So throughout his ministry, Jesus taught us to turn away from negative appearances, from all the bad or evil that we think we see, and return to the Garden of Eden. That's our life's journey, to return to the Garden of Eden, to the original goodness of our divine nature, to the ever-present and omnipotent goodness of God. It is for this that we were created. And it is in this consciousness that in magnificent divine energy, we co-create our good on this earth. And so it is. And let's just take a moment now as we prepare for prayer and meditation to affirm the nature of the divine, that there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in our lives, God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is.